Okay. Good morning, everybody. Everything running fine? Okay. So, as each week, do you have questions? Last week, we finished the area of anonymous communication with a particular view on mobile communication. So maybe you have questions concerning security and anonymity in mobile communication. And then we started into home or electronic banking. Any question? Please.
I have a question about wireless networks. You said that any mobile station can be identified when it is sending. Were you speaking about special identification codes that are used in network protocols, or about maybe special characteristics of radio signal that any radio sending device makes?
Okay, I just repeat the question. Maybe not everybody understood it or got it. Your question is, if I'm talking about here, my assumption, a mobile station is always identifiable and locatable if the station sends. Your question is, does this relate to any identifiers, addresses, or whatever the station is sending, or does it depend on physical phenomena of the transmitter? The answer, in short, is the second version. It's a question of the physical phenomena of the radio signal sent. Here you may assume that even two stations which are hopefully completely identical, same series in a mass production system, have subtle differences. So usually no two clocks are running exactly equally fast. No two amplifiers giving you the exactly same gain. No two, let's say, relative timings are exactly the same. So these kinds of phenomena vary, which means that people working for secret services tell us we can keep them apart. Of course, this is only true first if an attacker has good enough measurement equipment somehow nearby. If no equipment to measure those phenomena, no way to identify, no way to locate. Secondly, of course, it assumes that the radio channel is good enough in the sense that the radio signal makes it to the measurement equipment without too much distortion, at least without too much distortion of those phenomena which vary between different devices. So, in some situations where you say, oh, I have only very noisy channels, I have only channels where timing varies heavily because maybe of reflections or whatever you have, in those situations, you might make an assumption that you can't identify stations. But I would argue then you are taking some risk, because now you are making assumptions that in the situations which are relevant, the channel, the radio channel, is noisy, suffers from reflections, or whatever. So I wanted to be on the safe side. So I made the assumption a mobile station is always identifiable. So this is the answer to your question. And as a side remark, of course, I should say that if mobile stations are built, I say provocative, with no anonymity in mind, or quite the contrary, with easy identifiability in mind, then of course the first version of what you say is true as well. That is, if I have a mobile station and if it's sending its email address, its international mobile entity identifier, I don't know the name exactly. So each mobile station has a particular number which is particular to this device, which is usually sent when it books into the network. And of course, if this is the case, and if we are considering the network operator as one of the could-be attackers, then the game is over with respect to identification as well. Or if you take your laptop and you consider the MAC address, the MAC address is unique, hopefully, this is its purpose, unique worldwide. So if you want to trace laptops, try to get hold of the MAC address and then you have it. Of course, I would assume that criminals get a possibility to change the email address and get a possibility to change the MAC address. Okay, so do you have further questions or remarks or no, everything clear? Okay. Further questions? Okay, if not, then how about your homework? Oh, this is something we shouldn't do now at the moment. And maybe I should mute the tone. So, who did do any of the exercises and wants to discuss it? Or maybe even if you did exercises which were further in the past, I'm willing to discuss it. So, any exercises you want to discuss? If this is not the case, as I see, then by definition, because we agreed that you are treated as adults, we have done those exercises. Okay, if you come back to those exercises next week, it's okay for me. But I should remind you, next week is the last opportunity to do exercises, right? Okay. So then I continue with the lecture. And last week, we already started with, hey, does the banking system do automatic teller machines, does home banking have the security properties we would like it to have, or we would assume it has? And the result of this part here was that the clients have no security with respect to integrity and availability of their money against the bank. And I'm not only talking about the bank as an organization. Normally, I would argue that a bank is not cheating its customers. Usually, it doesn't. If a bank wants to get money from their customers or its customers, it's not cheating the customer. It's just taking fees. This is the normal way of getting money from the customers. So I don't assume that on a large scale, banks are cheating customers. But banks are using normal computer equipment, as we use. And we know that this equipment is not error-proof. It's making errors from time to time. And it's surely not secure in the sense that it can be hacked. So the problem is that if the customer hasn't any security against his or her bank, then this means if within the equipment of the bank there's any security problem, probably it's going to be a problem of the bank customer, if we assume the customer is taking liability. And if you read the fine print of your bank, then you will read you take more or less complete liability for everything which happens. You have the burden of proof. And of course, under reasonable assumptions, you can't fulfill the burden of proof, which means that if there's any dispute between the bank and you, mainly you can hope for the mercy of your bank. But mercy usually is not the foundation for a business relationship, right? So far, if you take the fine print as valid, and let's say 15 years ago, it has been taken as valid, because 15 years ago, lawyers just assumed computers are much more reliable than human beings. So if someone cheated and it's to decide whether it's the bank client who cheated or the bank equipment which cheated, then it's more probable that the bank client cheated. So the customer will have to cover the losses. In the meantime, even lawyers are working using computers. So they noticed that sometimes the operating system crashes. They notice that sometimes files disappear into nothing. And sometimes they even see that files are corrupted. So they know computers have a relevantly high error rate. And if you think about security updates, each lawyer gets to know, oh, each 2 weeks or each 4 weeks, I have to do a security update on my machine because in the meantime, there's proof that my machine is insecure. So I do a security update, hoping it gets more secure by that, and it hopefully stays secure until I'm told, okay, again, we need a security update because the machine is insecure. So the probability, or let's say the possibility, that a machine has been hacked or subverted for lawyers increased from literally zero 15 years ago to, okay, it can be subverted each week or two because a new security weakness gets published, some new exploits are published. So even kids and non-computer literates can exploit security weaknesses on normal computers. So what does this mean for a lawyer? It means, hey, the assumption we did 15 years ago that human beings are much more probable to lie than computer equipment, this is not true any longer. So what to decide if you are a judge? You will decide, okay, who built the system and who operates the system, this person has a burden of proof. Because this entity decided how to build it, this entity decided who has which log files, etc., etc., etc. So this entity has a burden of proof. And this is not changed by any fine print a customer signed. What does this mean? 15 years ago, the system was absolutely foolproof for the banks. Whenever something happened, the customer had the burden of proof, so he couldn't fulfill it. So he was in the hands of the bank. He depended on the mercy of the bank. in the meantime, it changed completely. The bank has the burden of proof. The bank mainly can't fulfill that. So the bank has to cover the losses. What's happening? The bank try not to get publicity for this. That's clear. If you're very vulnerable, you don't want everybody to know that. So the banks make sure there's no ruling against them, that whenever they are going to lose before court, just before they lose, they say, okay, we are covering the claims, just as an act of mercy. So they try to keep the feeling which was the truth 15 years ago. But if you have a good lawyer, it's very easy now to think about how you can cheat your bank successfully. I don't want to spell it out, because this is not a lecture how to attack systems, but it's pretty clear how you could do. Are the banks changing their system? At the moment, the answer is not. Why not? Because at the moment, for the banks, it's cheaper to cover the losses of those who have good lawyers. Banks don't bother about the losses of clients who have bad lawyers. It's cheaper for the banks at the moment to live with the losses than to fully re-engineer their system, which of course is a major undertaking, needs a lot of cooperation, because imagine, for example, Deutsche Bank would understand, okay, this system is crap, so we have to change it. Now German bank is changing it. And now the customers of German bank or Deutsche Bank can't use automatic teller machines of other banks. The clients won't be happy. Even if it would be in the best interest of client that the whole system is going to change, whoever starts to change it probably is going to lose clients. Which means that this completely insecure system has an astonishing amount of stability. It's hard to change. So what do you learn about this? Okay, when it started, automatic teller machine and home banking started as an option. Banks said nobody is forced to use it. If you don't want to use it, don't subscribe to that kind of service. And if you think this service is insecure, don't subscribe to it. Then you are secure and safe. In the meantime, it's really hard to get a banking card or a credit card without subscribing that you want to get the PIN. On the forms I had to fill out when I last changed my bank account, there was no option getting a banking card without a PIN. So I filled out the form. I crossed out that I want a PIN, and I did send it to my bank. After 2 days, I got a telephone call. Mr. Fitzman, this is impossible. Either you want to have your banking card, then you get automatically your PIN, and then you have to sign that you got your PIN and you're taking the risk, or you don't get a banking card. And I said, yes, I understood your form, but I want to have a banking card without a PIN. This is impossible. Okay, then I said, okay, could you please connect me to your boss? I want to discuss it with your boss. Okay, I got this it was now only a very short version of the conversation. It took me half an hour to convince that lady that I know what I'm talking about. She had the feeling that bank clients are completely stupid and don't know anything about banking, and in particular, they don't know anything about electronic banking. Okay, same procedure with her boss. And after half an hour, I said, okay, let's do a shortcut. Please connect me to that person who is willing to do the discussion with me on TV. I don't know who will be that person within our bank, but do you really mean that? I said, yes, I mean that. You may look up in databases. I'm at TV from time to time, and it gets boring for me. I don't want to do a discussion with several people, half an hour, whether I can get a banking card and a PIN separately. I decide I want to have a banking card and no PIN. Okay, I will try to check out, the lady said. After another 2 days, I got a letter, no, maybe a phone call. I'm not absolutely sure whether it was a phone call or a letter. Let's assume I got a phone call. Okay, you will get your banking card without a PIN. We respect your decision. We will put a clerk of the bank next to the printer who takes out the PIN letter at the moment it's printed and will destroy it. So you won't get your PIN, but you will get your banking card. So for me, the problem was solved. In some sense, I was unhappy that it was solved. I would have enjoyed having the discussion on TV, but obviously my bank didn't like that discussion, having it on TV. But please remember, is it realistic that bank customers do 2 telephone calls of half an hour each and then say, okay, now let's go to TV in order to get a banking card without a PIN? I would say this is mainly unrealistic.
But doesn't mean this, that your card still have a PIN, but nobody knows about it?
Yes, this is the situation at the moment.
So it is still possible to break, and how to break the PIN on the card?
Sure, but then it's not my problem, because I never signed that I want to have a PIN. But the story is not at an end. This was the intermediate state for 2 or 3 years. Then I got my next banking card. And regrettably, the person in front of the printer wasn't there anymore. So after 2 or 3 years, I got my PIN letter. And now if I would like to cheat my bank, it's pretty clear what I would do, right? I never signed that I want to get it. I got confirmation of my bank that I won't get it. So I could deny ever got it. But of course, I could sell the PIN and the data on my banking card to anybody, and then they could take money. And if I have a good lawyer, I wouldn't pay the bill. It would be the bank paying the bill. Of course, I didn't do that because I think the system is insecure, but I'm not encouraging exploiting insecurity. This is not the message of this lecture, right? But to make a long story short, if people like me and you would decide we want to bring down the system of automatic teller machines, we know how we would do it. Encourage and tell enough people how to cheat their bank, let's say, for 5,000 euros, and then do some calculation how expensive it gets for the banks. And so if you get some million people convinced that they could do it, the system just would have to be shut down. Of course, we have to admit that whether people would have good feeling if the system is shut down or bad feelings, it's absolutely unclear. I'm somehow idealistic. If I want to have cash, I go to an office of my bank and get cash. And when I came there for the first time, the lady at the counter tried to explain to me how to use an automatic teller machine, because she just had the feeling I came to her because I was unable to use an automatic teller machine. So she was very polite and told me, okay, first you do this and that, and then the money comes out, and it's much more flexible for you. And I said, no, I don't want to use it. It took me some effort. And in the meantime, they know me in this branch. So it doesn't need any further discussion. I go there, write some numbers on a piece of paper, I sign it, and I get my money. Okay. What would be my advice to you? Of course, I know not everybody can take the time and energy to live all parts of his or her life in a way he feels on principle it should be done like this. Many of us do compromises in many parts of our lives because otherwise it's too uncomfortable, it takes too much time, etc. So probably it's unrealistic that I try to convince you you should give back your PIN. Think about a procedure how to do that. And not use automatic teller machines anymore. I think this would be completely unrealistic. And probably at least most of you would start laughing about me if I would say, okay, this is my aim. So it's a compromise between ease of use and security. And of course, I have to understand that different people choose a different compromise for them. So what I want to make sure is that you know what compromise you are choosing. And as a hint, if you read the small print, okay, I know it takes some time, but I really would encourage you to read it. Then you will come across a paragraph which reads like this. The bank, of course, is obliged to hand out the money to the client as long as there's money in the account. That's clear. This is what an account is for. In addition, the bank promises to hand out even more money than you have on your account until to a certain negative balance. So for this part of negative balance, the bank gives you a guarantee that you get money. In German, it's Überziehungskredit. You get that automatically. And now it gets very delicate. The bank has no duty, but it has a right to even hand out money if it goes below that agreed balance. If it goes below the agreed negative balance. No duty, but the bank has a right to do so. Which means that the risk that you take as a client gets unlimited. Normally you would say, okay, what I'm at risk with my use of automatic teller machines. I'm risking the money which is on my account. Sure. You are risking maybe the money where the bank gives you a promise to hand it out. Sure. So let's assume you have a balance of 2,000 euros. You have an allowance to go in the negatives by 1,000 euros. Then your maximum risk should be 3,000 euros. Okay. It's a lot of money for students, but probably you would survive it. And maybe after some years, you would even argue, okay, I learned my lesson after it got the problem. But in reality, the bank might go below that. So if criminals are clever, the bank would hand out 10,000, 15,000 euro. And now I would say for students, it gets really a problem. You see what I mean? So at the very least, if you are using automatic teller machines, I would encourage you to go to your bank and do an agreement in writing with your bank that the bank has no right to hand out money below the agreed negative baseline of your account. So restricting, in my example, your risk to 3,000 euros. And then this choice, it's your choice, maybe a good choice for you, because you say, oh, I'm saving so much time, it's worth the risk of 3,000 euros. Okay? But taking an unlimited risk, I would say, okay, this is really tough. And you should think twice before you do that. And this is what bank clients do by default in Germany. Okay, so far, integrity and availability of money, right? And probably a common understanding that multilateral security would be a splendid good idea, right? Because otherwise, a system which initially was quite secure for the banks, but not for the clients, now if you have a good lawyer, it's completely secure for the clients, but not at all secure for the banks. Okay, now you can feel like Robin Hood and say, okay, this is nice, because now the banks are taking the full risk, but okay, neither the old state nor the new state is really fair. It's just technology is not as good as it should be. Okay. Now let's come to the red part. I mentioned that very shortly. If you are talking last week, if you are talking about electronic banking, it not has only problems with integrity and availability, it might also incur privacy problems. Why? If you know who is paying to whom, at which place, in a modern society, you are learning a lot. First, mainly you are gathering moving tracks because you know which person is at which time, at which place, because for most things you pay something. And secondly, you get to learn who pays to whom. So if I would send money to an Al-Qaeda account, then probably this would tell you something about my maybe religious beliefs, or being more frankly, about my ideological stupidity. So, getting to learn who pays to whom gives you a lot of information. So, if you think about multilateral security, can we avoid that a payment system is a perfect surveillance tool? And here I mentioned last week, and maybe I should describe it again and in more detail. There was a case study made in the US in 1971 where people from the police, from the Secret Service, etc., were brought together. And they were asked, if you want to establish mass surveillance without bothering people too much, how would you do that? And the answer is, or the solution that group came up with, the solution was, let's get rid of cash. Let's make sure everything is paid electronically. Then we know who is at which place at what time. We know how much money people spend, and so on and so forth. And of course, the case study was done for Russia, because it was done in the United States. You know that the Secret Service usually is not allowed to spy on their own population. So usually if Secret Service people do some kind of mind exercise, then they do it. What might we do abroad? Okay, in the meantime, we are, I would say, in some countries, close to that scenario. Ever more transactions, ever more monetary transactions are done without cash, but are done electronically. Some countries, I think some Nordic countries within Europe, even discuss whether cash should be abandoned completely, because cash is used in many criminal activities. So they have the feeling if they could establish that all payments have to be done electronically, they can bring down crime. Okay, so you see, with electronic banking, in principle, we have the same kind of privacy problem we just had or discussed with respect to communication. Of course, people want to use electronic communication in a privacy-friendly way. And I also would be able to pay electronically in a privacy-friendly way. And I would say criminals always will use some kind of communication which is not monitored. And criminals always will use some kind of payment which is not monitored. So even if you give away cash, then probably criminals will use gold, silver, lithium, cigarettes, whatever, as a new kind of currency, right? Okay. And now, this was the intro. So this now, hopefully, is a clear statement of the problems and what we have to solve. And now in the main part, you will get everything a little bit more precise. So you will learn how what I described can be solved cryptographically. Solving the blue part, that is, we will discuss properties, when is a payment system secure with respect to integrity and availability. Here we mainly will need digital signatures and come up with a straightforward design of a digital payment system using digital signatures. It's very straightforward. In some sense, I would assume if I give you half an hour, you would just invent it. So it's really not difficult. So the banks can't argue they never had an idea how it could be done. And secondly, with respect to the red part, which is the privacy part, I will give you an explanation how to use pseudonyms. That is, how to get rid of person identifiers, for example, your banking card or your bank account at the moment is a person identifier. Whenever you use it, you are identified as a person. And if you want to do some transactions and keep some privacy, having a person identifier as part of each and every transaction probably is a very bad idea. So have to think about how to use pseudonyms. And there are different classes of pseudonyms, and one class we might use is row relationship pseudonyms. I will come to the classification of pseudonyms later. Okay, so this is the plan, what to do. So first, before we can design any system, we have to make sure what properties we want to have. So what properties do we require to call a payment system secure? And with secure, in the first step, I'm focusing on integrity and availability properties, of course, including accountability. So what is a payment system at all? How can we express what money is, what currency is? How would you answer that? What is money? Because before we can create a digital version of money, we first have to understand what money really is. Otherwise, no way to implement it. Please don't come up with an idea, okay, money is I take a JPEG of some coins and then I shift the JPEGs around in my system and this is the way I'm going to implement digital money, right? So what is money? What is the idea behind money? No clue? Never thought about that? What is... Okay, you have an idea. So in some sense, money is a kind of promise of the creator of money to cover the value of this money by maybe some amount of gold, by some amount of whatever, right? So seen more abstract, money is that it gives you some right, which of course you may only use once. So a right which is exhausted if used. Okay, if we take that point of view with respect to money, then we can say a security property is that the user can transfer the rights, means the money received. So you can give to another person the right you have. Money is transferable. Of course, if you transfer the money to someone else, you should lose it. You should not be able to duplicate your money by just giving all the bits you have to someone else and keeping a copy. Right? Otherwise, I would say, for me, it sounds very nice, because then probably we would have enough money, right? Which could be a splendid good idea to organize some social processes within society, but, okay, probably a rethinking what society is about won't start with the ability to duplicate bits, right? But nevertheless, maybe a good idea from time to time to think about what society really is about. So, if transferring money implies that you are losing money, then of course you should only lose money if you really agree to transfer money. Otherwise, an attacker could just make you lose money without your consent, which is probably not what you really want. Third property is, if a user who is willing to pay money uniquely denotes another user as a recipient, only this entity receives the right. Maybe you already had that in mind when I talked about that a user can transfer the rights received, and maybe it was trivial for you that you can denote to whom to transfer the right, but okay, if you are in doubt in a specification of security properties, better do it twice or better do it too explicit. Fourth property, a user can prove transfers of rights to a third party if necessary. That is, if you paid, you want to be able to prove that you paid. In Germany, for example, you have the right to get a receipt on paper whenever you pay something. You may say this is typical German, because we assume first everybody has paper, everybody can write, everybody can read, and writing and reading and handing out paper is fun. So this is typical German. Maybe there are other cultures where there's no such universal right that you get a receipt and you pay money. But surely in a digital system, you need to have some proof that you paid. Because let's assume you're doing e-commerce, you paid something. The payment system doesn't give you proof that you paid. And then the recipient of your payment after a week said, by the way, it would be very nice if you pay the bill. Okay. Doesn't sound like a good e-commerce protocol if it cannot be clarified whether it already has been paid, yes or no. Last property. Even if users cooperate, and even if users try to cheat, they should not be able to increase their rights. They should not be able to generate additional rights. So as a user, you are able to transfer your rights to someone else, but you should not be able to increase the overall sum of rights within the system. In some sense, you should not be able to print digital money. Okay, so these are the requirements my group at Karlsruhe came across when we first started to think about it. They have been stable for at least 20 years, maybe 25 years. So is anything missing? Do you want to have any additional properties with respect to integrity and availability? Okay, I give it to you as a homework. This is a requirement document. And as always with requirements documents, it's really hard to know whether your requirements document is complete. In some sense, I would argue you never ever will know for sure. All you can make if you try to design secure systems, make your requirements documents explicit and make sure that those who you want to use the system later on consider the requirement document for completeness. So please take the perspective you are a user of the banking system. Are all your requirements met by this list of requirements? Please check that. Then you think you are a bank manager. Take the perspective of a bank manager and check again. Are the requirements complete? Then you take the perspective of the Minister of Financial Affairs. Think about the banking system. Are the requirements complete? Probably it wouldn't be a good idea if you take the perspective of a thief and think, are the requirements okay? Probably a thief will say, no, the requirements aren't as I would like them to be. So, okay, you have to take the perspective of all legitimate parties being concerned of such a system and check that, okay? So I really would urge you, take 10 minutes and check that. So next question is, what is a digital payment system? So what we had here, this should be true by each and every payment system. This should be true if money is represented in coins made of gold, and it should equally be true if money is represented as paper banknotes. It should be true if money is represented as bits and bytes. These, I would argue, are universal security properties of each payment system. So how about a digital payment system? What's particular? And here I would argue that mainly it's about the transfer of rights. With a digital payment system, you should be able to move money from one entity to another using digital communication. That is, it should be able to move money from here to there in an immaterial way. So I'm not talking about a communication system made up by doves flying around, and you put a banknote around the neck of a dove and you send it there. So this is not a digital payment system. Communication means digital communication, immaterial communication. So it should be possible to send money to someone by sending bits to that someone. Okay? But now, somehow we come across a problem. If you send bits to someone, and this means some money goes to that person, how do we make sure that you are losing the right? Okay, we could set up the rule that, okay, if you send the bits, you have to delete the bits on your computer. But, okay, wouldn't be security, right? We couldn't enforce that you delete the bits on your computer. So, if you can send bits, which means money, we have to make sure how you lose that money. Or if bits mean money, how do we make sure that the recipient doesn't duplicate the bit string and say, oh, I got twice as much money? So overall, the problem is bits can be copied perfectly. What to do about it? And the only solution I see is that we say, okay, bits can be copied perfectly, but they only mean money the first time they are shown. If you show them twice, the second version of the bits, the second copy of the bits, has no value. So, what does it mean to show it twice? So, showing to whom? And here I have the feeling we need some kind of witness. This can be a human being. It can be a computer. It can be an organization. But in any sense, it's a kind of physical entity with some kind of persistent storage. So then maybe better you don't take a human being, but maybe persistent storage is easier to implement with computers. So persistent storage to make sure that only the first showing of a bit string is considered to be money, if the bit string means money at all, right? not each and every bitstring is money, because otherwise buying a random number generator, which would make you rich fast, right? Which would be a splendid good idea. Okay. Next point is this last security requirement is very strong. The statement that users cannot increase their rights even if they collaborate is a statement because I don't mention time. It means it's true all the time, which is really hard. Because it means within a distributed system, you can make sure that at no time money, the sum of money is increased. Which means that within your user population, to avoid that, people have the impression that money is increased. Because whether it's increased de facto is one question. A more stringent assumption is all good users, all honest users, never ever can be tricked in a situation that they believe they have money, but they haven't. So if you see this, that there's no increase, you can see as a global property, but in addition, it means as a honest user, you should not get into a situation that you believe you have more money than you really have. Which means that the last requirement means that you have an online system. That is, each user, after each transaction, can communicate to the witness. And the witness I will call in the sequel the bank. So witness, bank, will tell him you have money or you haven't money. So you are the only one who has the bitstring, or maybe someone already cleared it. Or, okay, I accept you are the first one showing it, then your bitstring really means money. Without an online system, that is, without everybody, every recipient of money being online, wherever he or she may be, this cannot be built. Assume two people meet in a desert. One person has water, the other person has money, and the person wants to buy water for money. Splendid, good business model. I don't understand why German railways didn't increase the price of water within their intercities, and then they could earn a lot of money and build better technology for cooling down the interior. But okay, maybe they weren't fast enough to come across this idea. So let's assume in a desert, you buy something. You pay the person who gives you water. This person is offline, right? Now it could be that someone else pays another person in another desert. Maybe this other person is selling water as well. Could be wine, could be apple juice, I don't care. And gives to that person essentially the same bit string. Then this second person would have the feeling, okay, I gave away my water, apple juice or wine or whatever, and I got money. But in effect, one of the two later on will discover that he didn't get money. he got a bit string, which was a duplicate. So to make sure that this doesn't happen, somehow these two guys should be able to communicate, usually not directly, but indirectly by communicating with the bank, asking the bank, is this real money? So this requirement, which asks for consistency in some sense, is very strong and requires everybody to be online if he gets a payment. So offline payment systems, which are very convenient. Assume you're meeting someone in the desert. You really need water, but no mobile network accessible, so you can't buy water, then probably you will be quite upset and say, hey, Mr. Fitzman, you did overdo your security with your payment system. I want to pay water even in the desert without a network. And then either you introduce cash again as a fallback strategy, or you need a kind of system which is able to do offline payment. Okay, so we keep in our heads that later on we'll have to do some discussion about offline payments. But if you want to have very strong security, very strong consistency, then this means payments have to happen online, which means in each payment you have to contact your bank. And for example, in many regions in Europe, this is quite reasonable because coverage of mobile networks is good enough. Okay. Pseudonyms. Historically, there have been different papers talking about pseudonyms. This is a drawing from one of the very old papers I did write within my group. And at that time, we started that we could make a distinction between person pseudonyms and role pseudonyms. In the person pseudonyms, the kind of pseudonym which gives you the least anonymity is a public person pseudonym, so everybody knows that this is your pseudonym. This could be your phone number. You know that in the meantime, there's not only books where you have phone numbers, but there are CDs or maybe there are even online services. And in the good old times, when you had a book, it was possible to say, I have a name, I want to read the phone number. And if you didn't know in which city that person lived, then it worked. What you couldn't do at that time easily is you have a phone number, you want to know what's the person behind it. In the meantime, I would say this is pretty easy. If you are ever listed in a phone number directory, then this kind of reverse search will work. Why? Because it's not your duty as a human being to read through the whole numbers, for example, in Dresden, which would mean at least 300,000 numbers and entries. Reading all of them, or at least half of them on average, probably wouldn't be much of fun, right? But if you can make this job done by your computer, then okay, it's fast. There may be non-public person pseudonyms. For example, your account number usually is not public. At least if you're a private person, I would try not to publish it too widely. So whenever you get an email, hey, I want to get into a business relationship with you, and you get 40% of all the transaction values, and by the way, it's about 4.5 million US dollars, then probably you should be very skeptical sending to the sender of the email your banking details, right? There may be anonymous person pseudonyms, for example, biometric data, your DNA, and as long as there's no register where all DNA samples of the population are stored or of a larger fraction of the population is stored, then it's pretty anonymous. But of course, it's a person pseudonym because if we ignore identical twins, a DNA sample is unique for you. Or it's unique in the sense that it's describing you or denoting to you. Maybe if you have an identical twin, it might point to a set of two or maybe even three people, but that's it. If we want to get better anonymity, we could or should go from person pseudonyms to role pseudonyms. So maybe we should establish business relationship pseudonyms, for example, with your bank. You could have several accounts for different roles you play within society, or you could have a pen name. You know that famous writers once used pen names. Why this? Because before you did publish your book, usually, if it was a delicate book, you didn't know after publishing the book, will you be a hero or will you be an outlaw? And sometimes it depends. So maybe a splendid good idea to use a pen name. So if you are a hero, maybe later on you will say, okay, it's me. I was a writer. If the writer would get to become an outlaw, then you should think twice before you say, okay, it was me. It's my pen name. Transaction pseudonyms even go one step further. They assign a new pseudonym for each transaction you enter. So usually within a transaction, there's some linkability needed throughout that transaction. But after the transaction is finished, it's finished, it's closed, it's getting persistent. No need to link that to anything else. So this is very old. I think this picture we had in a paper of 1987, I think. Later on, now we are around the year 2000, we reconsidered what we once had done and had the feeling we should do it more in detail. And in particular, we should make a distinction between the initial linking between the pseudonym and its holder. So what is known about the relationship holder and pseudonym initially, and what is linkability introduced by the use of the pseudonym across different contexts. So with respect to the initial linking to the holder, we had the feeling we have to have three classes of pseudonyms. We have pseudonyms which are public. That is, the linking between the pseudonym and its holder may be publicly known from the very beginning. An example is the phone number which is listed in a public directory. The second class of pseudonyms with respect to the initial linking to holder is initially non-public pseudonyms. That is, the linking between pseudonym and its holder may be known by certain parties only. We call these parties trustees for identities. But in spite of these parties being able to link, there's no public information, at least initially, how to link. So this might be a bank account, an initially non-public pseudonym, with the bank as a trustee for identity. Or it could be a credit card number with the credit card company being a trustee for identity. Last, we have initially unlinked pseudonyms in the sense that the linking between the pseudonym and its holder is, at least initially, not known to anybody except the holder. So there's not even trustees for identities. So this may be true for biometric characteristics. It may be true for DNA, as long as we have no registers. So this is the classification. This is our current feeling about a classification of pseudonyms with respect to the initial linking to holder. The second aspect is that we can consider pseudonyms and their use across different contexts. And this use across different contexts gives us a partial order. What we had here is a kind of total order. With respect to privacy, initially unlinked pseudonyms clearly are better than initially non-public pseudonyms. And with respect to privacy, surely initially non-public pseudonyms are better than public pseudonyms. Or if you go even one step back, here also, if you denote it that way, we have a total order. We say with respect to privacy, this is worse than that, that is worse than that, and so on and so forth, the total ordering. With respect to use across different contexts, we only have a partial order. We can start with what gives the most linkability is a person pseudonym. A person pseudonym is used in all contexts, across all contexts. It's just whenever you act as the person being denoted by that pseudonym. This is pretty close to some advertisement you surely heard. You should always pay with your good name. Very stupid slogan. Because it means you should always decide not to have any privacy. Sounds fine. If you have a good name, why do you need privacy? Because maybe good and bad may change over time. And even at the same time, different parts of society may have a different feeling what is good and bad. So just saying, stating you pay with your good name just assumes there's a common agreement what good and bad is. And I only can say, if I say it very polite, this is really naive. And if I say it straight, this is strictly stupid. Okay, this was person pseudonym. Now, if you start to decompose your whole life into parts and using different pseudonyms in different parts, there are at least two ways to decompose your life. One way to decompose is with respect to roles. Within your life, you are playing different roles. For example, you are friend, you are child of your parents, you are a student here, computer science student, You are a member of a sports club, maybe. And usually with the role, there come different obligations, different rights. So a role usually is a bundle of what others expect from you and what you are willing to give to them. For example, if you are considering your role as a consumer, you could exercise the same role towards Amazon, eBay. Okay, your role is you want to get some goods, and maybe, what a pity, you have to pay for it. So this defines a role. Or if you are a seller, maybe you have some goods, you want to get, what a pity, some money for it, and then you are sending the goods. Okay, this is the role seller. Usually, with different roles, by the way, people can be very different. For example, I know people who are absolutely reliable if it's about their sports club. If they say, okay, we have a game to do, I will be there on time. But if it's about being on time in a lecture, it's a completely different game. So people behave in different roles quite differently. And I have to say, this is okay. It's fully okay. But of course, if now communication partners, if interaction partners have to make up their minds, is this a reliable person in the sense that if he promises to do something, he keeps to it, then maybe in the sports clubs you have a good reputation because you always stick to what you promised. And maybe in a university setting, where you think it's more liberal and the others don't depend on me, etc., etc., etc. There are many good reasons that you always can say, I want to learn it later. So very good reasons, yes. But in the long run, you will not have learned it, but you will be dead. But okay, slight problems if you overdo it. So you behave differently. So your reputation, whether you will keep your promise, will be worse. It's okay, maybe completely adequate. Meaning that if you decompose your life into different parts, in the different parts, you will have a different reputation, for example. And by the way, this is completely okay. There are many politicians, for example. I have the feeling they are good politicians. But I didn't like them to have them as a friend. Because maybe in their private sphere, okay, many question marks. And that's vice versa. There are people which are very reliable, very okay, I would like to have them as friend. But I never ever would elect them as a politician. Right? So just the assumption that you have a universal good name, a universal good reputation, in all the areas of your life, and it's all the same in all the different areas, I just can say, this is stupid. Another way to decompose your life is according to relationships. Whom do you know? Whom do you relate to? And then maybe this gives you some kind of subsetting of your life. For example, your girlfriend, your boyfriend. This surely is a relationship. Usually it may have many flavors. It may be a very emotional thing. it may be kind of a business relationship. So often you are asked, please could you give me 20 euros? Now, you know, you are in the situation of being a kind of local bank. Usually you give it. Hopefully you get it back, or maybe you give it as a gift and don't expect to get it back, whatever. So within the same relationship, you can play different roles. You can be a very emotional partner. You can be a local branch of the bank. You can be whatever. Of course, you could go, whether you start this way or that way, you could go a step forward and say, hey, I'm not only making a distinction according to the role I play, but I'm also considering the relationship. Then you get from here to there. And of course, if you here started with a relationship, you can go from here to there by considering the role you play at the moment. So maybe you should have a different pseudonym, which is specific for each combination of role and relationship. And we call that a role relationship pseudonym. So this kind of pseudonym is the most fine-grained way of using pseudonyms if you are talking about long-standing relationships. So if I tell you, making a nice joke, so let's assume your girlfriend or boyfriend asks you, hey, could you please give me 20 euros? And from the past, you know, okay, I never will get that back. It's a very nice person. He or she is very emotional, and surely I can rely on that he or she will help me if I need help. But with respect to money, he will just spend the money and forget it, which may be quite okay in some situations. So in the limiting case, if it's in a system which is computerized, you should get a warning that, okay, you can give these 20 euros, but probably you won't get them back. So maybe if it's done well, if it's implemented well, you just should give it as a gift, because then you get some emotional points as well, because you're losing your money anyway. So, okay. I know that if it's about human beings, probably you will see your relationship to your loved ones as a whole. So do I, sure. Sometimes you step back and you, at least mentally, if you are curious, start to decompose what different facets do we have. But still, you want to see it as a whole, right? But if it's not your loved ones we are talking about, but a company, an organization, things like that, then doing a kind of decomposition might be very, very appropriate and needed. Okay? But it's easier to explain if I'm talking about your loved ones and making some jokes. Okay? So if it's not about long-standing relationships, so it has a very compact context, it's only relevant within one transaction, then you should use pseudonyms which have only meaning, which are only used within one transaction. And this we call transaction pseudonyms. So transaction pseudonyms give you the minimal linkability across contexts. By the way, of course, now we are in a situation that we have to define what a transaction is. You can see Now it gets funny again. I'm using funny examples on purpose. You can see a relationship to your girlfriend or boyfriend as a kind of long-standing transaction, lasting for many years, maybe if you are very happy, lasting for the whole rest of your lifetime. Okay, then of course, a transaction pseudonym is pretty close to maybe a relationship pseudonym, right? But if you have the usual meaning of transactions, that they are short-lived, they have a well-defined context, they finish, hopefully successfully, and then it's done, then it makes sense, okay? Maybe we should mention some examples. Person pseudonyms, today in reality, it may be the number of an identity card. It may be in the United States the social security number. And it may be, at least in some countries, your bank account, if it's very uncommon to have several ones. Role pseudonyms, it may be a pen name. It may be an employee identity card number. Relationship pseudonym, this means a customer number. And a customer can be someone who's just paying or buying this. Maybe then he is in a position to require service, things like that, okay? Role relationship pseudonyms, this usually could be a contract number, spelling out whom you are dealing with and what is the particular purpose. And transaction pseudonym, this may be a one-time password, it may be a transaction number, or it may be a one-time use public key pair. You're just generating a public key pair to sign and test signatures. And you are using this key pair only in one context, only during the transaction. So this is what I want to say about pseudonyms. Do you have questions? If not, then I think we should make a break. In 20 minutes, we continue. So, okay, let's restart. Over the break, I got a first question or a first, hey, there's missing something with the security properties. And what was missing and was, hey, with those requirements, I could build a payment system which complete surveillance, so shouldn't we add some privacy requirements? And the answer is yes, should we should, sure. But as I noted here, security for those requirements mainly means integrity and availability. And anonymity and privacy is a completely different story. And we'll get to learn how to use different kinds of pseudonyms, different kinds of unlinkability to get payments untraceable. But the privacy requirements are not part of this list. Okay. So this is what I got to learn over the break. Okay, this was the last slide. Any questions? Okay, then we continue. The next part of the picture is taken from a paper some colleagues and I did write some time ago for lawyers. And there we tried to give lawyers a graphical representation mainly of digital signatures. because we had the feeling that usually lawyers don't like mathematics, but fancy graphics, it's enjoyable to them. So what did we do? You know what is in green here, that signing a message, you sign the message M. And then usually you transmit the message and the signature from X to Y. And testing the signature means you have a test algorithm which on input of the message, the signature, and of course the test key, which here is part of the algorithm, tells us whether the signature is okay or not. So this is a notation you know. For the lawyers, we did a graphical notation, which means we have a sender X and a recipient Y. We have a document M, so messages now are called documents, because this sounds nicer for lawyers. And we append a kind of seal to documents. And here we have a pseudonym of A. So test keys at that time, at least, it wasn't interesting for lawyers. Maybe in the meantime it's different because many lawyers are already using computers, so we shouldn't frame them as more stupid than we are. But at that time, when we did write the paper, it was 1987, I think, typically lawyers hadn't any clue about technology. So we appended a seal with the pseudonym under which the message is signed being the name on the seal, right? So this is a notation we are going now to use. And now, first I want to start what kind of transactions protocol we might have, mainly thinking about e-commerce. So let's assume we have a user X and a user Y, and these two want to do business with each other. Maybe one is a seller, one is a buyer, whatever kind of transaction you have in mind, and we want to do it using pseudonyms, providing as much privacy to both of them as possible. How it might be done? So the idea which probably comes to mind is, hey, user X could have a trusted third party A, which is able to identify X and gives X pseudonyms. Or maybe more precisely, X is generating key pairs. X is going to third party A, saying, hey, this is my public key, or more precisely, this is one of the many of my public keys. Could you please issue me a certificate that you know the person behind the pseudonym? So in case of fraud, in case of problems, you will be able to identify me. Then I can show this certificate I got from you that if I'm acting under the pseudonym, I'm identifiable by you, plus some messages signed relative to my pseudonym. This is then enough to do transactions. So this is what X does. Symmetrically, Y does the same. Y is choosing a third party, maybe a different third party, I call it third party B, approaches that party and says, okay, these are the test keys I generated. Please give me certificates for each of them that you can identify the holder of this pseudonym. I prepended before third party the word trusted. And usually, if you are talking about trust, it gets a kind of risky thing. So X is trusting A in which respect? X is trusting A that A will not just by accident or by bad intentions reveal the identity of the pseudonyms X will be using to the rest of the world. So A is trusted to keep some data confidential, except in situations where A is required to reveal it. What means trust for Y? In which respect does user Y have to trust the third party A? Y has to trust that if I have a conflict with the holder of the pseudonym, maybe he didn't pay but he should have paid, if I can demonstrate that there's a conflict, then A will give me the identity of X. So, with respect to A, X is trusting in a kind of confidentiality property, which of course is hard to validate, because how do you validate that someone kept a secret? This is tough. For Y, in some sense it's easier. Y is relying on that if Y needs the identity of X and has reason to require to get it, he or she will get it. And of course, this is easier to validate. If you think you should get it, you have proof that you should get it. If you don't get it, you will notice. Whereas with respect to confidentiality, if confidentiality isn't kept, probably you will be the last one on earth getting note of that. Symmetrically, with respect to trusted third party B, so the trust Y in B is keep the secret of who's behind the pseudonyms, and the trust of X in B will be, hey, if I have cause to know the identity of the yellow user, of user Y, I will get the identity. So if you look at the message level, then it might read that user X is signing a document with his red pseudonym, and he is adding a confirmation of A, so a confirmation issued to the red pseudonym and signed with the public key, with the public pseudonym of the third party A. And here we have for the pseudonyms a notation that we have as input for the pseudonym the identity, the true civil identity, and some kind of generator G. So we get different pseudonyms by having a different G. How is the other way around? Yellow is sending some document back to the red party, so addressing the red party under this pseudonym, signing its message by the yellow pseudonym and appending a confirmation of B, of the green party, that the green party knows the holder of the yellow pseudonym. So this is how it's done. What are the advantages and disadvantages of this kind of approach? First, an advantage surely is no need to change any business protocols. So what you do with red and yellow stays the same. Whenever a protocol runs in a non-anonymous setting, It can be straightforwardly extended to run in a pseudonymous setting by just checking these two confirmations, just checking that in case you get the identity. And then you run your protocol. Okay, what is, even without pseudonyms, the risk of those protocols? Okay, it depends what kind of business you are doing, sure. If you say, for example, user X is selling something to Y, let's say some digital goods, maybe a particularly designed something, I don't care. What do we send first? The good? How do we make sure the money comes? Or do we send first the money? How do we make sure the good comes? Of course, we can say, if it doesn't work out, then we are going to identify the person. But what do we do if just there is no money? Because the party participating is just bankrupt. Or how do we do if there is no goods? Because it was just a kind of overstatement that the party could do some artwork or whatever the service was. So somehow, this kind of protocol is risky in the sense that by the property of the protocol, you haven't a guarantee that it's going to finish successfully. Even the very simple thing that exchanging good against money, even this is not guaranteed, because whoever sends it first is in the weaker position afterwards. So what is done usually about that? What do? Before you send where to some destination as a seller, you try to get an awful amount of information about your buyer, because you want to make sure, first, he has money, secondly, usually he does pay, and so on and so forth. So usually this kind of protocol that you do business directly has a consequence that usually interaction partners start collecting as much information about the other, because the protocol in itself doesn't guarantee anything. So everybody tries to be careful and collecting as much money, as much information beforehand, in order to minimize risk. Of course, we can improve the anonymity property by saying it's not just one trusted third party which is able to identify, but a series of trusted third parties which can identify. So, for example, here in our example, X would know B. B should be a trusted third party as seen from X, and not only a trusted third party as seen from Y. So now the generalization is X knows a B1, a B1 knows a B2, and finally a BN-1 knows a BN, and this last BN knows how to identify Y. So same scheme as with mixes. Instead going one hop, you go several hops. So, to break the confidentiality property, now all the intermediaries have to cooperate. Of course, now we have a serious system with respect to reliability. If any of these entities is not operational, you can't identify. Therefore, you could generalize and say, okay, we have some alternative ways to do it And now we could repeat everything I said about mixes. Okay. So what is the basis of this pseudonymization concept? The basis is we did introduce trustees for identities. A and B are trustees for identities. And besides of this, we leave the business protocol as insecure, or maybe as secure, as it always was. So this is the first approach to build privacy into digital systems. And if you look at the situation in German law, this is a situation German law has incorporated in the meantime. That is, there are German laws which tell us whenever there's a possibility, a conceptual possibility, to use a service under pseudonym, the provider of the service has to offer it under pseudonym, or for users coming to the provider under a user pseudonym. I can't tell you whether this is really done. You can write anything into a law, and of course it only gets interesting whether the law is obeyed or not. But at least on principle, this should work within Germany. But of course, there's some tension. And the tension is, hey, this protocol works as good or as bad as these two people are in a position to fulfill the obligations they took. If within the protocol they take obligations they can't fulfill, the other partner will be in a situation of trouble. And if now these partners get pseudonymous, usually the other partner has no clue whether obligations really can be fulfilled. So somehow this kind of pseudonymization is exacerbating, is driving it to the extreme, the insecurity of the underlying protocol. But there's an alternative. The alternative is that we are using not two trustees, but one. And this trustee gets active. So goods and money are exchanged using the services of a trustee. So what did we have? Going back one slide. Here the trustees are only needed to setting up the thing. They are only needed to sign these confirmations. And then they are needed if something goes wrong. If both partners adhere to the business application they do with each other, no need for the trustees to do anything. So here trustees are only needed for setup and in case some party commits some fraud. Here we are needing the services of the trustee all the time. Whenever a transaction is done, the trustee has to be active. That's a downside, which means more work for the trustee. But the good aspect is that the security and privacy properties which can be provided are better. I even would argue they are much better, as we shall see. So how does the protocol work? Let's assume we have a customer X and a merchant Y. So a customer X wants to order some goods from the merchant. But X doesn't that directly to Y, but X does it via the trustee. So X sends an order to the merchant, yellow, plus includes into the order already the money for payment. And signs it, of course, with the pseudonym of red, right? But here, for this pseudonym, nobody on earth has a need to know who is behind. Surely, X did choose a pseudonym just to have a possibility for authentication of messages. But there's nobody who can use this information to identify who X really is, because we will not need it in the protocol. So this sounds, and this is, perfect privacy. The trustee does two things. First, he checks the order and the money for consistency. So if the order is, hey, I want to buy a book for 20 euro with Amazon, then the money should be 20 euros. Maybe even more, but at least 20 euros. If the order is, oh, I want to order some diamonds for my girlfriend and it's very expensive, maybe 1,000 euros, then of course the money has to be 1,000 euros or more, or at least 1,000 euros. Okay, if the trustee says and concludes that money and order are consistent with each other, then the trustee sends the order, but not the money, to the merchant. And the trustee includes, in forwarding the order, a statement that the money is deposited, which will give to the merchant assurance, if he does his part of the obligations well, he really will be paid. This is a guarantee he gets. And this is something in the former protocol he couldn't know for sure. So let's assume the merchant gets this message. He first checks whether it's really signed by the trustee. So he checks authenticity, sure. And then he looks at the order and has to decide whether he is willing to fulfill the order. If so, he fulfills the order and sends, this is step three in the protocol, sends the goods to the trustee. And of course, digitally authenticated with his pseudonym, which again is a pseudonym where nobody has a need to identify who's behind it. So the trustee if you are lucky is in a position to check whether the goods are okay. So there may be some goods where it's very easy to check whether they are okay, then maybe the protocol is run in that fashion, that the trustee checks it. And of course, there are other goods where it's hard to check. Maybe the goods is, this is a painter, and my order is, hey, you get a JPEG of my girlfriend, and I want to get from you a painting of my girlfriend. And I would like to get a nice painting of my girlfriend from you. And now if the painting which is delivered is nice, of course it's hard to decide, right? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, so okay. Let's assume the trustee is able to check. Then the trustee would check whether the good is okay and then send, in step four, the good to the customer. And, which might happen in parallel, the trustee may send the money to the merchant. And if the trustee really could check whether the goods are okay, the transaction is done. Maybe the customer will complain, I never got message 4, then you just resend message 4. Maybe the merchant can complain, I never got message 5, then you resend message 5. So surely the trustee has to store some bits for some time. But if the trustee really can check the good, everything is fine. Of course, for many situations that the quality of goods can be checked is not realistic. So what to do then? And now we are using a little trick. Now we are using time. The protocol is the same, step 1 and 2 and 3 are the same. But now the trustee should not send 4 and 5 in parallel, but it should send 4, that is, it should forward the goods to the customer and say, sorry, I couldn't check whether this is fulfilling your expectations, so please check yourself. And if you feel that the painting of your girlfriend is okay, then fine. Please let me know. Or more precisely, if I don't get a complaint by you, let's say within 2 weeks, then I assume the painting of your girlfriend is okay for you. So the next step, or the step inserted, is 4.1. The trustee will wait. In my example, 2 weeks. If nothing happens, he will, after the 2 weeks, send the money to the merchant. If during the 2 weeks he gets a complaint, then what do we do? Okay, we do the usual procedures we always can do. If X and Y cannot figure out how to get a good end or a compromise within the transaction, then probably the thing will go to court. And then a judge will have to find out whether this is a nice picture of a girlfriend. And usually judges are particularly educated to decide this kind of questions. If they have no special education for this, then they get some kind of expert witnesses, and then they ask, okay, so of course, I have to assume that the legal system somehow is able to decide about conflicts. If you don't do that assumption, then there is no secure business at all, right? So, what to do? We get a complaint from X. The money cannot be sent. The money stays with the trustee, because if the money is sent and sending money happens anonymously, then after the money is sent, nobody can force Y to do anything because he has the money, it's closed. Of course, now X could just complain to make sure that the merchant gets the money later, which usually in your business life means you are losing money, because getting money earlier, okay, you can gain interest. Or if you get it later, you have to pay interest for some credits. So usually what we would require is that if customer X is complaining to trustee T, and it's going to a long trial, because the decision whether this is really a nice painting of a girlfriend, maybe a very serious and hard to answer question. They need lots of expert witnesses, etc., etc., etc. So it takes a lot of time. And maybe even worse, you have to pay the expert witnesses, right? They have to write why this is good and bad, etc. So it costs not only time, it costs money. So probably if you are refining the protocol, the trustee should say, if you complain, which means you are hindering the money to arrive at Y, you have to insert new money, fresh money, just to hinder you, just to be a bad guy to that person without risking anything. So if you win your trial, you get your money completely back. But if you lose, then the money you pay, X pays to T, is used to compensate Y for the delay in payment. And of course, if expert witnesses, whether this is a good painting or a bad painting, maybe it costs a lot of money, then maybe even Y is required to deposit any money here to just cover the fees for the expert witnesses. So Holger Birk and myself, we invented that protocol, we published over it. Hopefully we didn't oversee anything. I'm optimistic. So we have a protocol which enables X and Y, which are completely anonymous, no way to identify them, to do business with each other, just by using a trustee T, which of course is known to everyone, so everyone can complain to T, everyone can hold T responsible for fulfilling the duties T has. And it works out. And it even works out in case of, or it even works out better, I should say, than this protocol. Because here, if one party just has not the funds to cover claims, bad luck for the other party. Which of course gives you some suspicion, which of course gives you some argument to collect data about the other party. Here in this protocol, if the trustee is working fine, each party gets what it deserves. So you have to show in the very first message that you have the money to pay. And in case the goods can't be tested, you get a reasonable time frame to check for yourself whether the goods delivered are okay. Otherwise, you can complain. And you get your money back if you are right in your complaint. Okay, so I would argue what Holger and I did is much better. And if you now look at the real world, what we have kind of sector-specific applications or e-commerce applications where we have at least to some degree this kind of trustee. Think about eBay. Think about some guarantees. I won't say that eBay has anything to do with privacy, right? So privacy is no driving force. But what you usually have is, if X wants to buy something from Y, could they use an intermediary which gives at least some guarantees by, for example, delivering reputation, by arranging for payment, etc., etc. So at least parts of what Holger Birk and I invented or described in, I think it was 1986, made it in real life during the last 24 hours, not 24 hours, oh, this would be nice, within the last 24 years. I would expect that if you want to have real privacy, offering these kinds of trusty services would be a really good idea. But of course, as long as eBay can make money without giving really good service, giving any guarantees, etc., etc., everybody will try to make the easy money. It's okay. But in the long run, I feel you only will earn money if you really are solving a problem. Okay, any questions? And maybe just for wording, we call this party a trustee for values, because this is what is entrusted to that trustee. He gets values, he gets the money, here he gets the goods, he checks, or if he can't check, he waits and distributes goods and money. Any questions? Okay, if not, then what did I assume? I assumed here we have money. Money can be checked and it can be transferred. And of course, I assumed all this can be done in a way that privacy is preserved. Because, of course, if I would argue X and Y can be completely anonymous, if later on in the protocol, just by transferring money, they can be identified, then probably I shouldn't make much fuss about privacy, right? So what I assume in this protocol is that there is anonymous payment system. So how could you think about an anonymous payment system? I start with a very, very simple thing, which is surely not perfect, but maybe gives you an idea that it might be possible. And then we go to more complicated systems with better properties. So how could you think about a digital payment system? Let's assume we are talking about a banknote, a payment of $10, a $10 note. How could we represent that? Okay, you could take a $10 note, go to your bank, put your note on the counter and say, hey, I would like you to create for me a digital banknote worth $10. Here's the $10 note. And by the way, I want to possess this digital banknote under a digital pseudonym. This is my pseudonym. Or maybe we start here. This is my initial pseudonym. Pseudonym one. Then the bank just takes your banknote, makes a database entry. This is a $10 banknote. And the current owner is the holder of pseudonym one. This has implications. It has the implication that if later on this banknote shall be transferred, this can only be done by signing a digital message relative to the digital pseudonym one, that you transfer the banknote to someone else. What do you have to know about this someone else so you can transfer your banknote? This someone else should have a digital pseudonym. So this someone else could have the digital pseudonym too. So in your transfer order one, you could state, herewith I transfer my $10 banknote from pseudonym 1 to pseudonym 2. Nice. And then it has, if the holder of pseudonym 2 is a different person than pseudonym 1, it has a new holder. Of course, if you are just happy to play around, the holder of pseudonym 1 and pseudonym 2 could be the same person, so you could play games how often you transfer it to yourself. If it's fun, okay. Over Christmas, maybe it's a way to get rid of the, let's say, boring weekend and, okay. This means that somehow digital banknotes are created by just depositing real money, and then they can be transferred as long as you wish. And of course, in the end, someone could show up with the bank and say, hey, I'm the current owner. I can prove it to you by just signing a message. And by the way, please delete the digital banknote. I want to have back $10 cash. Okay. Now the banknote is going to vanish. So what did we need? All we needed was digital signatures, nothing else. And of course, some kind of bank who takes some records. Who is the current owner? And who initially, of course, signs that this is a $10 banknote in contrast to a 1 cent banknote. Can the bank cheat? I would say no, it can't. As long as the digital signatures are secure, the bank cannot make out any transfer order. Nor can the bank sign any statement, I want to get back my $10 cash and please delete the banknote. So without knowing the signature key of the current pseudonym of the holder, the bank cannot do anything with the money. And in some sense, the bank can be held accountable about what she does, because the users can check each single step. So without breaking the digital signature scheme, this kind of payment scheme is secure. What do you do if you want to do a payment which is not just by chance, by coincidence, $10? Okay. We can say we have a different digital standard values of $10, $5, $1, maybe some cents, 1 cent. And of course, you could say, I transfer this banknote to the bank. If the bank gives me a $5 banknote, four $1 banknotes, and 100 1 cent banknotes, right? And maybe if it's about banks, then the bank will want to get some fees, okay? Usually you don't get any service for free. But for simplicity, let's assume it's for free. So whenever you have banknotes which cannot be used to pay directly, you're just changing your banknotes into smaller denominations, and then you can pay. And maybe you pay your bill by just transferring a set of banknotes. So for security integrity, I would say, hey, this is really fine. We have solved our problem with inventing a digital payment system.
But if the bank is the only one who assigns the value of
the banknote, it can manipulate the value of the banknote. For example, if we pay the bank the real $10 banknote, and the bank gives us a $5 digital banknote signed as a $5 digital banknote, then we can prove that we really paid $10 banknote at first.
Okay, let's consider the different steps and discuss it for each step. Initial step, I as a user go to my bank and put a $10 banknote on the counter. What I expect is that I get on my mobile phone, my smartphone, or my laptop, a digitally signed statement, you have now a digital banknote worth $10, right? If I get a statement, you have a digital banknote worth $5, then what would you do in your bank? You would just ask, hey, please, could you serve as witnesses? Here is a $10 banknote on the counter, and I just got a message that it's only $5. So this is the usual procedure when you are doing business in the physical world. If it doesn't work out, you complain immediately, and maybe there are some people nearby you can take as witnesses. If this doesn't work, then I would say you have serious problems in the real world as well. No need to discuss about digital extensions. Even in the real world, it doesn't work. Next step is you send a $10 banknote to your friend. But your friend already has the signature of the banknote by the bank that it's $10. And all which has to be done is here in the list of former owners to update the entry. So you send your transfer order to your friend, and maybe in parallel to the bank. And then your friend checks that he is inserted as the current owner. If this doesn't happen, your friend will complain with some authority checking banks what he can, because he has the list with the former state, he has the transition information, he can prove everything is okay, so he should be the owner. So he can check that. Third part of the transaction is that you send the 10 euro banknote to your bank and say, I want to get it into smaller denominations. Then it's clear you are sending $10, and in the message back, the bank has to send you a set of banknotes which sum up to $10. Otherwise, you can again complain. So I would argue you can check the well behavior of banks.
So if there are witnesses to what you have done?
Yes. Yes. Okay, so I would argue until here, at least conceptually, we know how to do a digital payment system which works online, right? It's working online only because for each transfer of the banknote, we have to assume that the bank is contacted, signatures are checked, and in particular, someone accepting a payment has to know who is the current owner of the banknote. Because if he wouldn't have online access, you could send a copy of a former state to someone and say, hey, I'm the current owner, but I only was some time ago. And then you could try to spend the banknote a second, a third, a fourth time. But given that you are online, so you can query what is the current state of the bank, maybe you can lock this state and say, please keep that state for the next 10 seconds because I'm going to rely on that, et cetera, et cetera. It works out fine. And I would argue that this is really simple. I would argue that if you have understood what digital signatures are, if you have understood that we need some kind of witness, a la bank, then it's pretty clear how to do it. Pretty simple. And in addition to this, in this protocol, we have already some degree of privacy, some degree of anonymity. Why? Or what do we have? If you go to your bank and you put your $10 note on the desk, depending on legal regulations, maybe you haven't to show your passport. Depending on legal regulations, maybe your fingerprints are not taken. Maybe some of your fingerprints are on the banknote, but usually they are not recorded. And depending on the style of your bank, maybe there will be no video of you showing up with your bank and putting it on the desk. Or at least if there is a recording, it's overwritten within a week. So even in this step, it could be done anonymously. But depending on regulations, of course, maybe you have to show your passport, maybe you have to give your fingerprints, maybe you have a video recording kept forever. I don't know. In the next step, you can act under a pseudonym, and you can transfer to other pseudonyms. So this gives you kind of anonymity and privacy if the underlying communication network keeps your privacy. Of course, if the network, the underlying communication network is traceable, then you can trace to the origin of the messages, and then you know who is the holder of which pseudonym. So depending on the particular setting, this could give you some privacy. Of course, there are limits. The first limit is, here you have a list from which pseudonym to which other pseudonym the banknote goes. This is recorded, and it has to be recorded for security, for the aspects of integrity and availability. What does this mean? Usually, you know, the holder of pseudonym 1 somehow did a transaction with the holder of pseudonym 2. Maybe even the same person, be the same person, but at least they know each other. Pseudonym holder 2 did a transaction with pseudonym holder 3. So it's not perfect. You can't argue that these pseudonyms have nothing to do with each other. There's no relationship whatever. So what you can do in short words is, since banknotes have an identity, you can, in principle, follow the identity of money. Each banknote has an identity. So if you want to get better privacy, probably it's an interesting question whether we can get rid of the identity of this banknote. And as we shall see in a few minutes, we can get rid of that, which means that we can get better privacy. But before we go that way, I still want to ask, is clear to everybody how this very simple scheme works? Because first, I think, if you know the very basic, the very simple scheme, then probably you have understood the basics. Okay, this is important in life. Secondly, if you have understood how it works, When you ever have to argue with your bank about secure payment systems, then you know how to argue, which from the standpoint of a citizen is a splendid good idea. Because if banks don't care about the security of their clients, the clients have to care. And in order to enable the clients to care, I have to describe a very, very simple scheme so they can really understand it. So by the way, if you meet your parents, maybe you try to explain the scheme to them. First, it might be interesting for your parents. And secondly, if you manage to explain it to your parents, then probably you are very well prepared for an oral examination. Because if your parents understand it, then probably I will understand your explanation as well. So sounds like a really good test. Okay, did you understand what I'm talking about, or are there any questions? Money transfer, yes.
Money transfer, then it's the same. Only the bank knows me and knows the other. And we are also represented by this number, which is a pseudonym. So what is the difference between this scheme and this which is used by digital money transfer?
Okay. In this scheme here, I didn't mention accounts. So usually money transfer in the sense of Überweisung, money transfer, assumes that bank clients have accounts and money is transferred between accounts. And usually, at least in the usual setting, it's assumed that you only can possess an account under your real name. And personally, I would argue this is a good idea because overall we have to pay our taxes. I will come back later how we have privacy and anonymity and still have to pay taxes, because I'm not a person saying I want to get rid of the country or this government or the state. A state has a role to play. By the way, he's paying for this university. Without the state, we wouldn't sit here, neither you nor I. So in the usual setting, if you're talking about Überweisung, we need accounts, and the assumption is accounts are owned under a civil identity. Here in this scheme, I don't need accounts, and usually accounts are taken to link together different transfers, no need. If it's about disjoint banknotes, there's no obvious leakage. And I didn't mention for the security of the system any need to have any way to conclude which pseudonym has which holder. But I think I should take your intervention as, hey, we should keep in mind that sooner or later we have to talk about how do we make sure that taxes are paid. Okay, I know nobody is very happy to pay taxes, but probably if we are realistic, we have to agree that at least some taxes are needed, because otherwise society and government just won't function. And by the way, if the government isn't taking taxes, then organized crime will. And it's easier to hold government accountable than to hold organized crime accountable. So far, I think I have very good reason to say that taxes are needed. Okay. Further questions? Because I think the basics have to be very clear before this is the case, we shouldn't proceed. Okay. Now it gets slightly complicated. Michael Weidner, Birgit Fitzmann, and I did sit together. It was, I think, in 1987, and we thought about, okay, is there a general and basic scheme of a secure and anonymous digital payment system? Can we get everything which is conceivable under one representation? And we tried. And still I would say probably we succeeded. In our case, this is a complicated graphics. It will even get more complicated over the next slides, but let's have a look at it step by step. First, it gets simpler by adding a blue line. Okay, this was first, this is the next. Why? Below the blue line, we have pseudonyms which have meaning within the larger protocol. So if you do an e-commerce protocol, the partners know each other under some pseudonyms. And above the blue line, we will have pseudonyms which have only meaning for the particular payment. So I try to get maximum unlinkability, to have different pseudonyms in different parts of the protocol. So what is the first step? The first step is that these two, payer and recipient, agree, and this is the choice of pseudonyms, this is step one, maybe I go back, they agree that a pseudonym valid in the larger protocol, so this is this here, and this is that here, these pseudonyms will be replaced by those two pseudonyms which are specific to the payment part of the transaction. Okay, so after you have understood this, half of the complexity of the graphic is away. Because now it's mainly necessary to know, okay, there are some pseudonyms which have a meaning outside of the payment transaction, and there are other pseudonyms which have a meaning only inside the payment transaction. So, we denote the pseudonyms inside the payment transaction by some kind of exponent B, B for bank. So assume this is PZ as pseudonym des Zahlenden, payer, and maybe this is pseudonym des Empfängers, PE. And with this kind of exponent B, it's the variant towards the bank, the witness. Of course, the names here suggest linkability. So PZB and PZ, if you look at the names, are closely related. But in reality, these would be unrelatable bit strings. So it's only here for the understanding of the protocol that there's an obvious linkability between the names. So, how does it work? Let's assume the payer X wants to pay to recipient Y. Let's assume we did arrange for the pseudonyms, because we need some pseudonyms just to denote to whom we are paying. Without any pseudonyms or any names, no way to describe to whom we want to pay. So now, the payer sends to the witness a transfer order signed by his pseudonym towards the bank. And he attaches that he has ownership of the right he wants to transfer. So whenever you want to transfer a right, you have to prove two things. First, you are the current owner. And secondly, you have to sign a transfer order. The witness is going to check whether these two match to each other. And he will send to the recipient, signed by the witness, signed by the bank, you got money. This is the amount. And by the way, you got it from that party. So here we have in the transfer order the identity of the recipient. And here in the final money transfer, we have it as well. And of course, the witness would this transfer authorization not only send to the recipient, but it would send it to the payer as well, because the payer should get proof that he or she paid. So far, we did everything above the blue line. So we just did execute the protocol according to the scheme we here had, right? Now we can do the protocol steps below the blue line. Why that? Because here above the blue line, we only have possession, we only have all the messages made for the pseudonyms used towards the bank. These are different pseudonyms than the pseudonyms used in the larger e-commerce protocol. So I would be very happy if the recipient, the payer, would send me a receipt for the payer that the recipient got under the pseudonym used in the larger protocol from the payer under the pseudonym used in the larger protocol, the payment. And of course, the payer sends the authentication for the recipient and that he did transfer the money to the recipient as well. So both give to the other confirmation that everything worked out fine, which means that the larger protocol, the surrounding protocol, may proceed. Now, of course, what do we do if neither X doesn't send step 5 or Y doesn't send step 4? They are anonymous. No way to force them to do anything. And the answer is, oh, we did step 1. If either 4 or 5 isn't sent, I can prove the equivalent within the larger protocol by saying, hey, by the way, we have mutually signed the equivalence of the pseudonyms within the inner and the outer protocol. We have all the receipts within the inner protocol, and so please take the receipts within the inner protocol plus the equivalence between the outer and the inner protocol as a replacement for the receipts in the outer protocol. Okay, works out. So if any of the two doesn't do the steps 4 or 5, then the other partner can link between the pseudonyms above the blue line and below the blue line and achieve the same effect with a little less privacy. So this is step 1 of the very basic scheme. And now I would expect that you have plenty of questions, because maybe there are some details, maybe you have some questions, so please ask. No questions. Okay, then I proceed. But you can bring me back to this slide whenever you want, And I hope that at least at home you will have a second look at it and think about it. The problem with this protocol is, as we have it here, that the recipient now gets some money, and when later he is using the money in the role of the payer, it will get obvious that it's the same money, money received here and money later on spent there. So until here, we have the problem that, going back, we have this list of who, one after the other, is the owner of the money. Only relative to pseudonyms, but still we have this sequence because we have an identity of the units of money, an identity of the banknotes. Now we are going to change this, and this we do by introducing another step within the protocol, step 6. And here, in step 6, the recipient is changing the representation of the banknote. And later on we will learn how this can be done. And the idea is using blind signatures for this purpose. So what is money, after all? Money is that the bank signs you some bit string. And of course, if you are using ordinary signatures, the bank knows which bit string it is signing. If you now consider using for signatures blind signatures, then we could make sure that the bank does not see what it is signing. And if we make sure that the amount of money the banknote is worth is not depending on the bit string signed, but only on the signature. So you have a different signature for $10, for $5, for $1. And it's not you have a different bit string being signed for $10, $5, $1. Then it's obviously okay that the bank doesn't know which bit string it is signing. So please repeat, this is a remark I once made when we talked about blind signatures, that I said, okay, you can use it, it's a nice tool, in particular it's a nice tool for payment systems, but it's only a nice tool if the value of the signature only depends on the signature and not on what is signed. Because otherwise you would be completely stupid if you sign it. So whenever someone gives you a piece of paper and says, okay, did write something in the upper part of the paper, but I don't show it to you, please sign it below. It's enough that you know you sign it below. Then probably you would say, hey, this is absolutely stupid. Hopefully nobody would do that. I'm not sure whether nobody would do that. If you would tell customers or citizens, oh, this is a new fashion, how we do contract signing, then maybe at least half of the population would do. Okay, so here we would like to do a change of the banknote in the sense that the recipient can deblind the blindly formed signature, so he can transform the banknote, which enables the recipient, if he later on in another protocol takes the role of the payer, to come up with a banknote which never ever anybody had seen. And of course, that this banknote here is signed blindly by the witness has also the consequence that without deblinding, the banknote just isn't valid. So in some sense, if you do this step, here a banknote is disappearing into nothing, as seen from the outside. And here, if the recipient later on takes the role of the payer, a banknote is appearing out of the blue. Which of course is very nice to keep the step of receiving money and spending money unlinkable. So this is a really fundamental step for privacy. To be frank, of course, there are some applications where I would say this is really nice. For example, if you pay for medicine, this payment shouldn't be related to whatever. On the other hand, if it's about money laundering, that money disappears somewhere and reappears others and it's completely unlinkable for money laundering, I would say, hey, it would work perfectly, but supporting money laundering usually is nothing I want to support. So it's a nice tool, and of course as citizens and as government we have to see and check where should it be employed and where shouldn't it be employed. But first the statement is, this is about engineering and cryptography, it's possible. So if we want to spend it again, we would here, now we are just incrementing the time t. So until here we had t as the time, and now here we are introducing the next time step. So in a new role we could spend the money we once got here. Okay. How to do blind signatures? The idea is you start with the text X, you blind it, the blinded text is submitted for signing, it's signed. It's unblinded, and then you check whether it's genuinely signed, whether the signature is okay. And so you have here X and the signature, and the outcome of your test, pass and fail. So here the party signing will never see X. It will only see a blinded version of X, or in some sense we could call it an encrypted version of X, encrypted by the random number Z prime used for blinding. And then in unblinding, you are using the same number X prime for unblinding. So far the concept, and now an implementation with RSA. So this is just, RSA is a digital signature system as we had it. So this is an old slide, you should remember it from lecture maybe in spring. And now if we take the protocol, how blind signatures are done. I call this here, because we can convert it one time, a one-time convertible authentication. Then we have a recipient who wants to get the blind signature. We have an issuer who is signing blindly. So the issuer, in my example, it's RSA-based, is publishing a test key N, and test exponent N and modulus N. So TN is the public key. So the recipient chooses a pseudonym, which may be the banknote number, for example. This P can be a test key of an arbitrary signature system. It can be, again, a test key of RSA. It can be a test key of GMR, whatever you like to. Then we apply a collision-resistant hash function H to P and concatenate the two. So we make sure that we have some kind of redundancy, which will lead NATO just to prevent attacks on RSA. Next, we choose a random number R, equally distributed randomly in Zn star. Zn star, by the way, was the set of plain texts you could sign with RSA, but only a subset, only those which have a multiplicative inverse. Don't see that we need it. We then take what you created here, P with some redundancy, and multiply it by the random number taken to the exponent T. This product we submit for signature. So it's signed by the recipient. It's signed by the issuer. So you see, if we are taking a product to the exponent S, this means we take the first factor to the exponent S and the second factor, and you know that T and S cancel each other. This was an RSA property. So what stays here is R. And now if we did choose R to be an element of Zn star, R has a multiplicative inverse, R to the minus 1. So we can multiply with this. Loosely speaking, we can divide by R. And now you have the pseudonym signed with the RSA secret key. So this is a protocol how we could sign a bit string P, which might be the test key of a signature system, adding redundancy, blinding it, preparing for signature, signing it using RSA, and then using the homomorphic structure of RSA to make sure that effectively you signed the first part, and the second part you prepared by taking it to the exponent T, here taking it to the exponent S, knowing that T and S cancel each other, so it's only R remaining. So you can divide by R, and you get what you want to have blindly signed. So this was RSA as a blind signature system. Don't get too much in the sun. I think now we have summertime, and maybe I even overdid my wishes that it should really get summer when we had this very, very long winter. And if I look at the temperature, then I assume many people overdid their wishes to having a long summer. See you later.